You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although Chris Adrian has loosely based his latest novel, his third, The Great Night, on William Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, his version of the story has a dark and violent underside that wasn't in the Shakespearean comedy. Mr. Adrian has said his version of the story, which concerns the intersection of a trio of heartbroken and damaged human beings with an otherworldly collection of fairies and a shape-changing monster in and around San Francisco's Buena Vista Park. Great Night is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased it has brought Chris Adrian back to our show. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me back.
The critics have been divided as to whether your novel should be described as a retelling of Shakespeare's play in a contemporary setting or as a sequel to the Shakespearean original. Do you see it one way or the other?
I guess I saw it mostly as a retelling, though I certainly see how it could be described as picking up where the play leaves off. I think I had in mind to hew a little closer to the play than I ended up doing.
It's one of those plays that directors have been very happy to set in different times and in different places. Does it lend itself to that?
I think so. Certainly, part of getting ready to write the book was reading the play over and over and trying to find as many different versions as I could, and just in terms of visual representations. I was surprised at how eventually I started to think I wasn't really going out on a limb much setting it in contemporary San Francisco.
But you did decide to base this on a classic, and we've seen a number of writers basing their new works of fiction on classic novels or plays. What was the appeal of Midsummer Night's Dream for you? Because there's a lot of stuff out there if you decide you want to do that sort of thing. I probably would have tried to do a modern version of War and Peace.
I think that's the next novel. I think the play ended up choosing me in a funny sense. I had known for a while I wanted to try retelling a Shakespeare play just because there are a number of novels that I admire a lot where people did that.
Lear especially.
I had a formative encounter with the Jane Smiley book as an undergrad. So I knew for a while I wanted to try it, and never quite knew which play to choose. And then living in San Francisco, I moved there back in 2001. And for my job in the hospital, I lived on the opposite side of Buena Vista Hill from the opposite side of the hill from the hospital. So I would have to walk through on my way to and from work. It's a funny little park, a sort of very carefully considered and cultivated little wilderness that looks very special all the time, but at certain times of the day, if the fog is rolling in and the light's hitting it just right, it's a pretty short stretch of the imagination to think something very peculiar or even magical might be happening in there. So the physical presence of the park and the idea that I, as the next project, wanted to try and do a Shakespeare play, didn't take too long for those things to percolate in a way that landed me with this project.
Well, the last time you were here to talk about your short story collection, A Better Angel, you talked about pursuing a graduate degree at Harvard's Divinity School, working as a fellow in pediatric hematology and oncology at a San Francisco hospital, in addition to writing novels and stories. This draws upon at least two of those things and the bark. What happened to Divinity School?
So I finished finally. It usually only takes only takes 3 years to do the degree that I was pursuing. It took me six, but I did finally finish. I think a lot of, though the Divinity stuff or theology, I guess in general, didn't make it into this book as explicitly as it did in the the second novel, which is about the end of the world and a second biblical flood. I think that the ways that Divinity School ended up shaping my oncology practice made it in to this novel and in the portions that touch on the pediatric oncology world.
How did Divinity School affect your oncology practice?
Part of the reason to go in the first place was I thought that learning to be a minister would make me better at taking care of people or being present for them, at least in a way that was useful for them, or at the very least not annoying to them.
Because it requires a certain amount of sensitivity to be an oncologist. People are often quite sick and in many cases are going to die.
And in the pediatric world, you're very often coming into somebody's life at the absolute low point of their life together so far as a family, at least, if not their life in general.
And part of this story involves a young child who is gravely ill, which we'll get to in a moment. But I was curious about the advantages of using a well-known piece of literature as a jumping-off point for a new work. Are there advantages? And I'm assuming there are quite a few disadvantages.
Mm-hmm. I think the advantages are having a plot kind of ready-made and delivered.
That you can bounce off of.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes just knowing what happens next is a great relief. Though I think there's a little bit of a bait and switch in that you do get the broad narrative outline, but what actually makes the story go, you end up having to provide yourself. And if there's not a urgent and compelling reason for you to be telling your own part of the story, you're sticking into that armature. I think it's likely to fall flat both with you and with your reader.
My guest is Chris Adrian, whose latest novel is called The Great Night. It is published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. And as your novel opens, it's three main mortal characters: Henry, a pediatric oncologist. I'm not saying it's based on you. Molly, a Divinity School dropout who's working as a clerk in a flower shop, obviously not based on you. And Will, who's an arborist, enters San Francisco's Buena Vista Park from different directions. Although they don't know each other, they're all headed for the same party.
Mm-hmm.
They're all suffering from terrible heartaches. You want to tell us a bit about why?
So part of that, the sort of urgent and personal reason found to tell the story involved a particular relationship that fell apart in just the right way, and me being aware of why it fell apart in just the right way, and still hoping to repair it, such that it became suddenly urgent and necessary to tell a story about love.
Well, this is still the stuff of modern novels, but then you have this parallel story, which involves two characters who you borrowed directly from Shakespeare's play, Oberon and Titania, the king and queen of the fairies. And you've made them pretty similar.
Yeah, they're certainly supposed to. When the names are supposed to go along with the very same characters that are described in the play.
The way you take liberties is with Puck, who is a kind of a in the Shakespeare, he's kind of a jester. Mm-hmm. You made him into a monster.
Mm-hmm. Though he always, even in my, I guess the earliest time I encountered the play was as a relatively young reader, and even though he's described in relatively jolly or innocent terms, he always frightened me very deeply.
So you always thought of him as a malevolent character,
or at least as an embodiment of chaos that contained possibilities of disruption that were really scary to me.
Now, unlike Shakespeare, your fairy king and queen have a child who suffers from leukemia. Leukemia would not have even been a diagnosis in the 17th century.
Yeah, so they're different in that sense that they, instead of just fighting over this mortal boy, they're fighting, but they're fighting on account of of grieving over his death. He doesn't survive his leukemia, but the starkest difference between this Titanian Oberon and those characters are that these two actually really love this child.
How much did you draw upon your experience as an oncologist, a pediatric oncologist, and writing about their boys? And he's called Boy, although mm-hmm. people want to give him other names. Their boy's illness and death, and then dealing with the grief that follows. It's been my experience, and because I've known some people who've had cancer, that the oncologist usually loses interest when you realize that the person is going to die. They're only involved up to the point where they think that somebody can be saved.
Oh, I think in the adult world, there's some handoff between the oncologist and the palliative care physician, especially these days, and there's a transition from one specialty to another. In the pediatric world, it's not quite so straightforward, so we tend to be the physician of record and the physician of attachment for the family up until the very end.
One of your novel's more lighthearted subplots involves a group of homeless people who live in and around Buena Vista Park, and they're creating a musical play called Soylent Green, based on the movie, the 1973 science fiction movie?
Uh-huh.
Charlton Heston,
exactly.
Your favorite, or is it you are a Richard Fleischer fan, the director?
I think I'm probably more of a Charlton Heston fan. But I was I watched that movie for the first time as a sort of joke movie night with friends, but we all ended up being being very affected by it and thinking, you know, we had picked actually the wrong movie for a bad jokey movie night. But the part of the most attractive appeal for retelling the play was the opportunity to redo the Pyramus and Thisbe bit that the Mechanicals put on at the end, which is my favorite part of the play, maybe my favorite part of all Shakespeare, and maybe one of my favorite parts of all literature.
But nobody plays a wall here.
Mm-mm.
When you were here before, you talked about working on two books, one for adults and the other for young adults. I'm assuming this is the adult book.
Correct.
Have you worked on the young adult book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got a whole draft done and showed it around. And the common reaction was, what part of this novel did you think was appropriate for children? So
you got to change it for adults?
I threw out the old draft and have restarted, and it's not really any less dark, but it's a lot more fun than it was.
I imagine it's hard for you to write anything that isn't at least a little dark. Chris Adrian is the author of Gob's Grief, The Children's Hospital, and A Better Angel. He was selected by The New Yorker in 2010 as one of its 20 under 40 writers. His latest novel, The Great Night, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I want to thank you for being with us again.
Thank you very much.
Up next on Backstory, Ian Begg from the European Institute at the London School of Economics reports on today's meeting of the European Council to discuss another bailout for Greece. And then later on Underreported, we'll get an update from the Horn of Africa, where almost 10 million people are in need of food aid, plus find out why getting some of that food aid to Somalia has been so complicated for the State Department. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC is supported by 92nd Street Y, presenting Jazz in July from the 18th through the 28th. This Thursday, it's a night of music by Benny Carter, led by singer Mary Stallings and sax player Phil Woods. Tickets at 92y.org/jazz. LV Wood Floors, producers of bespoke wood flooring. Sustainably harvested and reclaimed woods with eco-friendly coatings, all made in the USA. LV Wood Floors, 24 West 20th Street, lvwoodfloors.com. WNYC is a media sponsor of the 37th anniversary of Harlem Week, a month of events celebrating the culture and history of Harlem. Information and a schedule available at harlemdiscover.com.
I think that my insights into Mr. McLuhan will have a great deal of validity.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Well, that's funny, because I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. You can learn a lot about Marshall McLuhan when WNYC celebrates the 100th birthday of the visionary who taught us that the medium is the message. Join us for the special Marshall McLuhan at 100, tonight at 8 on 93.9 FM WNYC.
The European Council has been in an emergency meeting today to devise a plan for what could be another rescue package for Greece. But Greece, which has 350 billion euros in debt, isn't the only country in the eurozone that has been having major economic problems. Last week, investors became concerned about borrowing prices in Spain and in Italy, which is the third largest economy that uses the common currency. Joining us to discuss the atmosphere surrounding today's meeting and what's come out of it so far is Ian Begg, professional research fellow at the European Institute at the London School of Economics, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show for this backstory segment. Hello, Ian.
Hi there.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Nicolas Sarkozy met yesterday to discuss the options. Did they come up with any kind of agreement?
Well, they claim to have reached a joint position that they would present to their fellow European leaders. We don't yet know exactly what that contains because the meeting is only just finishing as we speak. So when they agree, a lot happens. So that's good news.
Didn't the European Central Bank head, Jean-Claude Trichet, also join the meeting in a kind of surprise visit?
Well, the media may report it as a surprise, but I'd be very surprised myself if he were not directly involved in such a meeting, because it involves very big stakes, very big commitments on the part of both the French and German governments as well as the European Central Bank. So it would be like having a meeting between the US and Canada on monetary issues and not inviting Ben Bernanke.
Chancellor Merkel and President Sarkozy lead the two biggest economies in the eurozone. Is their agreement likely to have served as the basis for today's negotiations?
I would expect so, yes, because there are two or three teams involved. If you look at the panorama of different EU countries, there are those which are opposed to spending much more, which are led by Germany, those such as France, which want to find a solution involving a bigger involvement of European-level governance, and there are what you might call the supplicants, the countries that are subject to the bailouts, like Greece especially, but also Ireland, Portugal, and those at risk, like Spain and Italy.
There are reports that the deal would push Greece into selective default. What does that mean?
If only we knew, Leonard. If only we knew.
Selective default.
I think the confidence trick that everybody's been trying to pull off, in both senses of the word confidence trick, conning people as well as restoring confidence, is to do it in a way which does not oblige Europe's banks and even US banks to write down the value of the Greek debt on their balance sheets. That would have the same sort of effect as Lehman Brothers had in 2008 of risking financial stability and risking a freezing up of the interbank lending market. If that happens, we could well see a rerun of the severe recession that hit the whole world in 2009. So maintaining the fiction that the Greek paper is still valuable is a key part of this. So I think that what's going to happen is the definition of default that will come out will be rolling it over, making it cheaper, and extending the period so that everybody believes that 100 still equals 100.
Well, in the past, Jean-Claude Trichet has argued that Greece should not be allowed to write down its debt. But isn't this going to be something like that in effect?
Well, no, that's the distinction between a write-down, which is repaying 50, 60, 70 cents on the dollar or on the euro, compared with keeping it at 100 but extending the period.
Uh-huh.
That's what rollover means.
There has been a lot of talk about doing that in a number of cases, which would suggest that you're putting everything off until things improve?
Well, there is a compelling argument for doing precisely that, the reason being that European banks, very much like U.S. banks, are still fragile after the severe hit they took in 2008 and 2009. So enabling the banks to improve their balance sheets for a couple of years would make it far easier for them to absorb an eventual Greek default.
Well, José Manuel Barroso, the president of the European Commission, has said that action must be taken. And that commission has suggested a plan that would encourage investors to swap their older Greek bonds that are expected to mature in the next 8 years for new 30-year bonds, as well as a tax on Eurozone banks that would be used to buy back 20% of Greece's outstanding debt. But haven't Germany, Finland, and the Netherlands opposed parts of that plan?
They have, and the reason they're opposed to it is their public opinion and their more rabid newspapers, such as Bild Zeitung in Germany, take exception to bailing out to the feckless Greeks, as they see it.
But are they really bailing out the Greeks alone? Aren't they bailing out their own banks who've lent money to the Greeks?
Yes, but the newspapers don't go so far as to get that subtlety into the rhetoric that they're pushing. And what actually happens is exactly as you described. It's the bondholders in France and Germany especially who are at risk from a Greek default. So bailing out Greece is in effect bailing out the French and German banks indirectly. But that's not the way public opinion sees it. They see it as being, why should we hardworking Germans work till we're 67 so that a Greek can retire at 50 on a very high pension?
Well, so isn't it the role of the government, the job of the government, to explain these things to their public?
Well, you'd think so. But there are direct parallels here with the impasse between the U.S. Congress and the president on dealing with the U.S. debt. It's very easy to see what you want to get from it, but persuading the politicians to bend, to make somebody else, they always want somebody else to pay for it rather than themselves. So it's a lack of leadership or a lack of urgency about dealing with what is, after all, a pretty severe problem.
The EU is doing another round of stress tests on its banks. What are they trying to learn with those?
Well, these were completed and published last Friday. They showed that a number of banks failed, nothing really major, no major banks. And the idea was to test whether they would be capable of dealing with problems that would arise for a number of reasons. But these stress tests did not include a Greek default. So some are being critical of them and saying they weren't tough enough.
In the last 14 months, the EU has helped bail out Greece, Ireland, and Portugal. Is that leading to a sense of bailout fatigue among the Germans?
Yes, that is part of the political objection. But the objection in Germany also has a different dimension, which is a fear of the constitutional court. I can say this in German. Do you want to be impressed? The Bundesverfassungsgericht.
I am impressed.
That's about 18 syllables, if I count correctly. And this constitutional court has the power to say to the German government, we do not believe what you're doing is constitutional, and therefore you must stop. And that's one reason that Angela Merkel puts forward for having been as cautious as she has. Now, others say that the problem is elsewhere. It's just that she's been reluctant to take on public opinion and to show enough leadership. So she's been criticized as well for being very slow to react and not leading from the front.
Ian Begg of the European Institute at the London School of Economics is our guest on today's Backstory Look at the European Council's meeting to discuss another Greek bailout. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. President Sarkozy was the one who made yesterday's meeting happen. He traveled to Berlin, and Germany seemed to be cool to the idea of another bailout for Greece. So is he going there to kind of to convince Angela Merkel or to take the pressure off of her?
Well, I think everybody knows a solution is needed, and you can't keep postponing it. Indeed, one of the lessons from previous episodes of this sort is it's better to take quick action than to take precisely the correct action if there's a choice between the two. Now, the German hesitation has been about finding exactly the right way through, whereas what I think Nicolas Sarkozy is trying to do is to say to her, look, we must sort this out now and not let it fester on for much longer.
Even if the European Council can't agree on a bailout, are there other ways that they might seek to reduce the strain on the countries, like reducing interest rates, extending the amount of time for bonds to mature, as we said earlier, or buying back bonds?
Yes, I think all of that's on the cards. There's also a suggestion that other more indirect mechanisms within Europe can be deployed. There is, for instance, something called the European Investment Bank, which lends money, a bit like the World Bank does, for long-term projects. for economic development-related projects, and it's suggested that maybe the Greeks could be offered bigger credits with this European Investment Bank to put in place, let's say, infrastructure projects or educational reform. So there's that way. And then there are the solutions which many people in the market seem to think are necessary. For example, the huge German insurance company called Allianz supports a view that I've also been very keen on, which is that it's time to create what you might call euro bonds. That's collective bonds for all that would cover all the public sectors of the euro area and not have them fragmented into national ones. What seems to happen is that the markets at the moment are able to pick off one country at a time and attack it. Whereas if you have a centralized euro bond, much like the T-bond in the US, it'd be far more difficult to attack it. And a further advantage of following that route would be that there'd be something much more coherent for investors like the Chinese or the Gulf states to put their money into if it was a single euro bond. The trouble with this story, the Germans are against it because it would cost them more in the short term. But I think it's asymmetric. The Germans might have to increase the interest they paid by a little bit, whereas the big reduction would be on the countries which are vulnerable. They might go from paying 5, 6% to 2.7, whereas the Germans might go from 2.5 to 2.6.
Well, the European Central Bank has warned that another bailout for Greece poses a risk for the larger economies. But you seem to suggest there were there's no other way to go about it. Now we have the added problem of Italy, which is the third largest economy in the Eurozone. Why are investors worried about it?
In a word, because Silvio Berlusconi, the prime minister, has a propensity for shooting himself in the foot. Maybe he's echoes of Dick Cheney in this regard. What happened is a couple of weeks ago, Berlusconi criticized his own finance minister and said that he was being too hard in the budget reductions he was seeking. The markets didn't like that. They thought, well, if the prime minister and the finance minister are at war, then Italy is going to be in trouble. Now, that's been settled because the finance minister very cunningly managed to get the austerity package that he was advocating through the two houses of the Italian legislature last week.
So, although it involves spending cuts and tax cuts not going into effect until next year. So there's a certain symbolic aspect to this austerity measure.
Well, no, because it's medium-term plans that count in this regard. And I think if you look at the arithmetic of Italy, it's different. It has a deficit of just over 4% of GDP. Now, compare that with the U.S. deficit around 10%, the Greek one around 10%, even the British one at around 10%. And you see that it's a much more comfortable position the Italians start from, despite the fact that they have high debt.
Is Berlusconi seen as a reliable negotiator by the other heads of governments in the EU?
He's seen as a loose cannon, and I think that his influence in European circles is diminished because of that.
Should Americans be happy about all of this? Will the value of the euro go down a little bit during the tourist season?
I doubt it, because let's face it, there's an equally intractable problem on your side of the Atlantic with the problem of the debt ceiling.
Mm-hmm. Which cancels it out. Britain must feel very happy that it didn't join the eurozone.
Well, there has been a sense of that good English word, schadenfreude. Pleasure in the suffering of others. But I think it's been very muted in the UK. Indeed, often in Britain, the sense is much more, we need this problem solved because it's our biggest export market. We have big connections through the banking system. So we do not want to see things going wrong in the euro area. And perhaps surprisingly for a political party that's been quite hostile to Europe, the Conservatives in the UK have been pretty supportive of what's going on.
Ian Beggs, Professional Research Fellow at the European Institute at the London School of Economics. Thank you so much for talking about what's been happening with the Eurozone and the possibility of another Greek bailout on today's backstory.
Pleased to do so.
We'll be right back.